Okay, thank you, Dan, for your introduction. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here. You know, strangely enough, I came only here once, very briefly, on the invitation of Jim, years ago, and I think it's the second lecture I give in Santa Barbara in my life. So what I want to do today is to tell you about some questions concerning the issue of Bose-Einstein condensation. This is a very old problem, which you might think is well understood, and the basic theory goes back to the late 40s. It's very, very old. But I think there are still a number of important pending questions, and I will try to survey them, some of them at least. And as you will see, my seminar will have mostly questions and few answers. Okay, so first of all, I begin with the beginning. Well, everybody knows about the Bose-Einstein condensation of an ideal gas with no interaction and in any dimension bigger than 2, a finite fraction of particles condensed in a single state at t equals 0, and this so-called condensate population goes from 0 at the Tc to the total number of particles at t equals 0. The corresponding quasi-particle excitations are just monitored by the kinetic energy and they have a quadratic spectrum as befits free particles. Okay, so that is taught in any first year course in statistical physics, and it's quite familiar. It is also has been known for a long time that if you put repulsions between particles, that changes the physics, and in fact the repulsions are the key to superfluid behavior, as we shall see shortly. If you put repulsion between the particles, it has a number of consequences. One consequence is the fact that the system now has a finite compressibility, and therefore the long wavelength excitations become sound waves, monitored by the compressibility of the gas, macroscopic sound waves. So the spectrum of excitation, instead of being quadratic, is linear at small q, those are the so-called phonons, and turns back into the pre-particle branch at very high q. That defines a characteristic length or wave vector at which you go from one regime to the other. It's basically, I will estimate it shortly, it's basically the scale of lengths over which the kinetic energy and the potential energy are comparable. And this coherence x psi is roughly where you go from the linear spectrum to the quadratic spectrum. Now, this picture is very much idealized because it refers basically to a weakly interacting system. Simply to remind you of physics, this is the corresponding spectrum for liquid helium-4. Which has little resemblance with that, but you recognize here the phonon branch and here quasi-particle spectra. In that case, you are very far from this idealized picture. So finite compressibility is one thing. The other thing are quantum fluctuations. If you are at t equals 0, the interactions can take 2 particles at k equals 0 and scatter them into the plus q minus q state. Therefore, you act to deplete the condensate, which is a typical effect of quantum fluctuations, and which is, in fact, a measure of the strength of the interaction. If the interaction is weak, depletion is small. If the interaction is strong, depletion is large. Again, taking helium-4 as an example, the depletion in helium-4 is thought to be 92%, so we are extremely far from the ordinary weakly interacting Bose gas. Last of all, but important too, it has been known since Landau, very long ago, that the fact that you have a finite velocity here is responsible for superfluidity. It is this finite velocity which guarantees that for small velocity Vs, you have a metastable state. Basically, if all these interactions have a positive energy, they are not excited by the flow, and therefore there is a critical velocity which is the minimum value of omega over q. Okay, all that is 30 years old. Forget about it. Now, the one question which has not been addressed very much in the past is, why is it that all the particles are in a single quantum state? When superfluidity, superconductors are superfluid helium are thought to be the epitome of quantum behavior on a macroscopic scale. Now, that relies on the idea that if I go in a ground state, for instance, all the particles are in the same quantum state, say with momentum k equals zero. Now, one may ask the question, couldn't you have what I would call a fragmented state, in which this condensate k equals zero will split into two very nearby states, k1 and k2, so that the kinetic energy is as small as I want and can make it negligible. And this fragmented state then will be a statistical mixture of particles in a state n1 and particles in a state n2. Now, if this happens, it has dramatic physical consequences because it essentially kills all quantum effects. For instance, it kills the quantization of circulation. The quantization of circulation comes from the fact that all the particles are in the same momentum state. So if instead of condensing them with momentum k equals zero, I take the first excited momentum in a ring, 2 pi over L, I will get a velocity and a circulation of velocity, which is a multiple of a quantum, which is just h over m, the Young constant divided by the mass of the particles. It is clear that if I have a condensate, which is a statistical mixture of two different states, however close, I can play now in the velocity on the fraction of particles which is in state 1 and the fraction of particles which are in state 2, and therefore I can make a circulation of the macroscopic velocity which is anything between two successive flux quanta. So the internal coherence of the state, the fact that it doesn't break into two states, is something which is crucial to superfluidity, and that was recognized long ago, again, by the Landau criterion. It's another way to state the Landau criterion. You only get superfluidity because you have a finite velocity. Okay, so to put it in more mathematical terms, that means what I'm asking, if I have two states, 1 and 2, I can make a condensate which is either a quantum coherent state, which is a superposition of all the particles into the same combination of phi1 and phi2. And of course, there is a phase difference, which is free. I can put an arbitrary phase on the phi1 component and the phi2 component. So in this pure state, single pure state with a population n1 and n2, I will have a density matrix, which has the usual diagonal terms n1 and n2, and cross terms that result from the phase coherence of the two states. And this is opposed to the incoherent state, which is written here, in which I have no up diagonal terms and only written the diagonal terms. And now ask the question, why do you always have that and not that? Is the difference a small negligible energy or not? And the answer is very simple, and strangely enough, not widely known. The answer is that what makes the state coherent is the exchange interaction energy. Now, I can do it in
five. This sounds like a kind of problem when one has to worry about the subtle interchange of limits, taking the box to infinity, the size, the time in which it's going to reach.
Absolutely. I mean, the kinetic energy, as you point out, is 1 over L squared. Okay.
How fast you lower the temperature.
So
for any finite size box, you don't have this problem.
Oh, yes.
Because the problem you state.
Because in finite states, I always pay the kinetic energy, but I pay kinetic energy which is of order 1 over L squared. Okay, the momentum is of order 1 over L, and therefore I pay kinetic energy which is 1 over L squared.
Right.
I'm going to show you now that you pay an energy which is 1 over L squared times the number of particles which is L cubed, say in 3D.
Right.
So it's L. I'm going to show you that you pay an energy of order L cubed, an extensive energy.
Oh.
So that's the key issue. Okay.
So, but I'm still confused. So, if I have a finite box, I don't have to worry about your problem, or so I still have to worry?
Well,
about
of course you have. It's the same issue. It's the same issue. So, let me now take a two-particle repulsion and write it in the usual way. Okay, the Bs are the creation-destruction operators for the bosons, and this VQ is for your transform of the pair interaction. Now, I'm going to compare two states, the pure states, coherent state and the incoherent state. And I calculate the expectation value of the exchange of the energy, psi v psi. If you have a single state, there's only one way to contract the operators. Okay, and therefore I get an energy which is 1/2 v zero and n minus one, which in the thermodynamic limit is just 1/2 v zero n squared. If I have a fragmented state, then I have, as usual, a Hartree interaction where I contract the extreme operators here, and I have a Fock interaction, exchange interaction, where I do the cross contraction. The Hartree term, which is a blue term, generates the 1-1 interaction, the 2-2 interaction, and the 1-2 interaction. I recover exactly the same energy as I had for the pure state. So the Hartree term is the same in the pure state and in the fragmented state. On the other hand, now I have the green term, the exchange energy, V12, Fourier common K1 minus K2, times N1 and N2. And this is a macroscopic energy. It's an extensive energy proportional to the size of the system. Therefore, cutting the condensate in two parts for a repulsive interaction has a price, which is an extensive energy, which is much bigger than any kinetic energy that you were mentioning. So the real issue is exchange in this problem. All right, so we conclude exchange is what holds the condensate together. Okay? And if you do that, then you can very easily convince yourself that this effect is independent. The fact that I'm using Hartree approximation is irrelevant because all the diagrams, which are not Hartree diagrams, are the same whether you fragment the condensate or do not fragment the condensate. It's only the interaction then, the term is 4 and 0 that these terms are important. But now an obvious issue comes. I've told you that if you have a repulsion, the system is a pure state. How about an attraction? If you have an attraction, the exchange energy is negative, and therefore I will gain energy by breaking the condensate. Now, for a long time, I thought that this was a problem of semantics, because if there is an attraction, then there is no stable ground state. If you take a Bose gas with an attraction, it collapses to a point. I mean, basically, you can try the Hartree wave function, which gives you an energy 1/2 n squared v smaller than zero. Variational theory tells you that the actual ground state is even lower, and that has a downward curvature to minus infinity, so the system collapses. So it's not really worrying, except that now, with this recent development of alkali gases in traps, one can achieve a metastable state with an attractive interaction. Now, this is not a theoretical problem. This exists in nature. If you trap lithium-7 atoms, which are bosons, into a trap, they have a negative scatteringness corresponding to an attraction. So this does exist. And now, why are they metastable? For a very simple reason. If I have these trapped atoms, and the energy is the sum of three terms, the kinetic energy, and if I call R the radius of the trap, okay, it's just h bar squared mr squared. I have an interaction term, which is proportional to the density of particles, so it's minus n times the absolute value of V. V is negative, so I define the absolute value of V, divided by R cubed, the distance, the radius of the system, that the density is n over r cubed. And there's the trapping potential, which I take to be an harmonic potential, which is m omega 0 squared r squared. Now, you see very easily that if you plot this curve, there is a region of parameters where it has this shape here, and therefore the state here is attractive but metastable. Okay. Now, the relevant parameter, if you want to have a little more accurate statement, the relevant parameter, which I've called eta, is the number of particles times the scattering length, which is a measure of the interaction V here, divided by A0, the radius of the first ground, the first state of the harmonic oscillator, which is the dimensionless ratio. Now, when this parameter is smaller than 0.5, you have this red curve. If it is larger, then you have collapse. Okay. So let me focus on this case here and ask a question. If I Bose condense attractive fermions in my system, what will be the condensate? It's not a stupid question. It can be measured experimentally. And so it's something which is worth thinking.
N in here is the total number of particles?
N is the total number of particles. That's right, yeah.
So often quite a large number.
No. Well, this parameter can relate experimentally span 1. I mean, you can make it smaller than 1, larger than 1. It's typically the values of a parameter. No, the number of atoms goes from 10 to the 3, 10 to the 7, or 10 to the 8. It's not so large in these traps. I mean, they are not it's not the Avogadro number. You trap a relatively small number of particles. So I do not have the final answer to that, but there was a couple of years ago a very interesting paper by Mike Gunn and his group. Mike is in Manchester, and or Birmingham, he's in England anyway, one of the two. If I make a mistake, it will be infuriated, but I simply forgot. Maybe he's in Birmingham. Now, you look at this problem, and it's an exercise. It's not supposed to treat any physical system achieved experimentally. It's an exercise in calculus, but it raises really an issue. So we looked at this problem, took a two-dimensional gas in an harmonic trap. So this is a Hamiltonian for the dimensionless gas, kinetic energy, and the potential energy, the trapping energy. And he added a small contact interaction, okay, between particles, which is measured by eta. And he assumed that the gas is dilute, so that you can really use a perturbation expansion in powers of the interaction. Now, if you are in the ground state, the issue of breaking the condensate does not arise, because the ground state is non-degenerate. I mean, the harmonic oscillator has only one ground state, and so you cannot break, fragment the condensate without paying the trapping energy, paying one quantum of the trapping energy. So in the ground state, there is nothing. But if you look now at states with a finite angular momentum, then the situation is different. If let me assume that the trap is isotropic, which is what I have assumed here, then angular momentum is a good quantum number. And the total angular momentum, quantum number m, and the total angular momentum is a sum of all m values of the angular quantum number times the number of particles in that state. And now I'm going to ask, what is the lowest state at a given value of L, since it's a good quantum number? Okay, it's a well-defined problem. Now, if you have no interaction, it's very simple, because we can solve this quantum problem in two lines. The eigenstates of this harmonic potential are exactly known, and they are characterized by a radial quantum number and this angular quantum number, and the energy is 1 plus 2 nu, nu is a radial quantum number, plus the absolute value of m. That's in textbooks also, standard. So if I want to minimize the energy at given L, I should only occupy positive m, because if I occupy negative m, I pay in energy and I lose in L. So I will only occupy positive m's. And so the total energy is simply this quantity here. And of course, I will take the radial quantum number equals 0. It is the lowest radial state, which is obvious. So the energy is simply the total angular momentum plus the number of particles. But now there is a large amount of choice, because for a given L, I can achieve it by spreading the particles among the M states as I want, as long as I only occupy positive M states. So there is a degeneracy, and my fragmentation problem arises. I mean, is the ground state 1M the same for everybody, or does it have a statistical distribution? Now, what Mike did, it is exact quotation mark. He did a first order perturbation theory among this degenerate manifold, treating V to first order, but diagonalizing the matrix among all possible states. I mean, it doesn't expand in V, but it's first standard degenerate first order perturbation theory within the ground state manifold. And what does he find? And strangely enough, when he found that, he had not seen this work of ours on fragmentation, which is quite old. I did this work with Saint-James in the early 80s, so it's very, very, very old. He was not aware of it, and so he certainly was not biased, because he didn't know about the whole story. And what he found is that if you have a repulsion, then all atoms are indeed in the same quantum, have the same angular momentum, q bar equal L over n, assuming this is an integer, of course. I mean, there is no statistical fluctuation. And if you have an attraction, found that you have a different situation, that of course the average value of Q is the same because that provides the total L, but it has a width, and the width is proportional to the square root of Q, where Q bar is the average value here. So here is an example which has not been confirmed, but which seems to show that if you have an attractive gas, you might well destroy the coherence of a Bose condensate. And that's an important issue which is worth thinking about. So the issue becomes even more striking if you take bosons which have an internal degree of freedom. And well, there are many examples. For instance, if you Bose condense atomic hydrogen, you have the nuclear spin, which is an internal degree of freedom. If you condense the system in a pure quantum state, I mean, a spin 1/2 is always pointing, is plus 1/2 in a given direction. Any state is ferromagnetic in a given direction. So if all the particles are in the same quantum state, that means that the Bose condensate is a ferromagnet. Okay, so something which you can see experimentally. Another example are excitons. Well, people have been looking for a long time for Bose condensation of excitons with, well, it's, things are improving, but I don't think it's completely settled yet. But you could try to have Bose condensation of optically active excitons, which have an electric dipole moment. If the Bose condense in the same quantum state, that means that you have super radiance, that all the dipole moments point out in the same direction. So again, it's something which is physically important to ask this question. So, and of course, the standard example I've mentioned here is helium-3 superfluidity, where you make a bound pair with L equal 1, S equal 1, and all the physics of superfluid helium-3 is due to the internal coherence of the condenser. So the question is to what extent does one have a density matrix which is a pure state or a statistical mixture, as I said before? Now, there is I'm much older than everybody in this room, so I remember an episode which few people know about. And in 1960, my friend Pierre Morel was a student of Finn Anderson, and they worked together what is now known as the A. Anderson-Morel phase of superfluid helium-3, the A phase of superfluid helium-3, which is a coherent superposition of two atoms bound in an L equal 1, S equal 1 state. In those days, Pierre was working in the French embassy in this country, and he had to get a French degree because we did not recognize American PhDs in those days. So, I was his correspondent in France, and then a month before the final exam, a paper appears in GETP by two obscure Russian theorists claiming this is all nonsense, the gravity is isotropic. And the two obscure physicists, as you can see, were not so obscure, as I said. That was rather dramatic. So we were panicked for a while, and eventually we convinced ourselves that their state had a higher energy on this state here, so that Anderson, he could go through his thesis with no difficulty. But it was a matter of numbers. And so the issue, it took me a long time to realize that what these people were doing was just building an incoherent superposition of condensates. So that if you populate all the states equally, of course you restore isotropy. But it's a different state, it's no longer quantum coherent. So this is a piece of history. Because the issue is quite old. The paper by Gorkov and Galitsky, 1961. So, I have again no well-defined answer, but I have some examples which hint that indeed there might be situations where the condensate is not coherent. And let me look at this example. I take one of them. To the case of spin 1/2 bosons, so you can scream bosons are integral spins. Okay, they are doubly degenerate. Atomic hydrogen is a spin 1/2 boson, just two nuclear spin states. Okay, so don't be too touchy about the language. I put quotation marks on purpose. So I'm going again. These bosons have two states, I call up and down, and I'm going to compare a coherent state, which is all particles in the same superposition of up and down, okay, and with an incoherent state in which I will have a density matrix which is just an up and down here. Now, let me put on these bosons an interaction which has a scalar part. Now, clearly this is going to be irrelevant because it's the same every possible state, and an exchange part, J. And I want to compare the energies of these two states. Now, if I work in the Hartree approximation, okay, simply putting all particles in the k equals 0 state and calculating psi h psi, then I get a rather disappointing result that the energies are the same in the incoherent and coherent state. And the reason is that if you have a pair interaction, and if you put two bosons in the same orbital state, symmetry tells you that they are in a spin triplet state. So whether it is coherent or incoherent is irrelevant. Symmetry, statistical symmetry, tells you they are in a spin triplet state. So the energy is always 1/2 n squared times u, the scalar interaction, with j over 4. That's simple. So you say that does not fragmentation, that does not answer fragmentation because the two states have the same energy. And of course, if I return to my old picture with exchange, that means that particles with opposite spins have no exchange energy, which we all know, of course. So that's not surprising. Of course, if I go beyond the mean field approximation, the Hartree approximation, then the situation is different because quantum fluctuations will be different in the pure state and the incoherent state. Now, the pure state is a ferromagnetic state, as I told you. Any spin 1/2 state is plus 1/2 in some direction, the SU2 group. And therefore, I know the quadratic, the excitation will be spin wave with a quadratic spectrum. That follows from spin hydrodynamics in the ferromagnetic state. If I have an incoherent superposition of up and down state with no magnetization, I get an incoherent paramagnet, and I know the excitation will be linear in Q, like they are in an antiferromagnet. So that means that I will have different zero-point energy, and this degeneracy between coherent and incoherent will be lifted. I did that calculation long ago, but I couldn't find my notes. But as I remember, I never published it, the coherent state wins. Okay, so we're happy coherent state wins. But now, let me make the Hamiltonian a little bit more complicated, return to the mean field approximation, and try to lift this degeneracy by using an anisotropic exchange. So I put a JZ, which is different from JPEP, which is perfectly allowed, something I can do. Now, that's going to split the m equals 0 state and the m equals plus 1 state, okay, of the bound pair, plus or minus 1. It's like an anisotropy field on the spin 1 particles. And you see immediately, if we do the algebra, which is sketched here, that if you are in, if you have a JPEP, which is larger than JZ, then the ground state, the incoherent state, is higher than the coherent state, which means that the system is ferromagnetic. And of course, that you could guess, but if JPEP is dominant, it will like to have all the spins pointing in some direction in the XY plane. So that's logical. But if JPEP is smaller than JZ, in this Hartree approximation, the very lowest approximation you can think of, the ground state is a mixture. Okay, so this is not the proof, a general proof of any sort, but it simply says that this issue of internal coherence of a Bose condensate is not as trivial as one might have thought originally. I mean, it's something which is which requires more thought. It has been assumed to be automatic for a long time, and I think it is not necessarily automatic, neither as regards the kinetic energy, that is rotating bosons in a trap problem, or regarding the internal quantum state, as I showed you in a specific example. So that might be a matter of pure theory, because the only superfluid we have at hand is helium-4 or helium-3, But with the advent of this Bose-Einstein condensation of alkali atoms in traps, I think the physics is opening immensely, and therefore these questions may become relevant. Okay, so much for this part of the talk. Now I am going to spend some time telling you about various things that can oppose Bose condensation, and there is basically one is localization, okay, and the other one is the dissociation of bosons into two underlying fermions, the obvious example being superconductivity turning into a normal metal. So much for first localization. Now, I'm definitely not a pro of localization, but some simple ideas are worth putting forward. The obvious example of localization is helium 4 again. If you press on helium 4 at 24 bars, it becomes a solid. A solid is something which is localized. Okay, and this direct transition between superfluidity and what would be an insulator for a conducting system, I think, is a very general feature that will come again and again in this series of lectures that I'm supposed to give. Now, for helium 4, the orders of magnitude are fairly obvious, and have been known a long time ago. Basically, the liquid is a phase that optimizes the kinetic energy, because the states are in low momentum state and have low momentum, but you have a finite chance for the particles to be close together, so you pay in interaction energy. So the liquid will be favored at low density. The solid does just the opposite. I mean, you localize the particles so that they are far from each other, so you optimize the potential energy, but you pay kinetic energy to localize the particles. So you know when the transition will occur. It will occur when the kinetic energy and the potential energy are the same order of magnitude. If d is a distance between the particles, which means the density, 1/(n⁻³). If d is a distance between the particles, the kinetic energy for localization is h bar squared or mv squared. The potential energy is nv. And in 3D, that tells me that this transition occurs when the coherence energy, which we have defined before, is of the order of the distance between the particles. If the coherence energy is larger, the liquid wins and you have a dilute system. If the coherence energy is smaller, the system eventually crystallizes. So this problem was addressed in a number of ways long ago. The first work is absolutely antique. It goes back to Matsubara, I think, in 1949. Okay, and Matsubara noticed that a hardcore boson gas, where the bosons move at a hardcore and move on a lattice, on a discrete lattice, is isomorphous to a spin 1/2 problem. That's fairly obvious because each site has only two states, zero boson or one boson. And because there are bosons, you have a commutation rule between different sites, which is just algebra of spins. So it's an exact isomorphism. The interaction, the hopping energy is like a transverse coupling. The nearest neighbor interaction is like a Z, an Ising coupling. So you have an exact isomorphism. Now, if you have only the kinetic energy, we all know that the spins are going to line up in the same direction. So if I force a given number of particles on my lattice, which means fixing mz in the spin problem, I will have ferromagnetism in a direction which makes an angle with the quantization axis here, so that the value of mz is what I want, is the number of particles. And of course, the azimuth of this angle here, azimuth of the spin, is just the phase of the other parameter, the Bose order parameter. So that mapping was noticed by Matsubara a long time ago, and there were a number of papers on this subject, and one particularly important one was a paper by Mike Fisher and one of his students in early 70s, who looked at the competition between the solidification and superfluidity, and look at the possibility of a mixed state, which would be a solid and a superfluid, with a claim that this was possible at the time. Okay, so this was just a model. There was much more recently what I think is a very interesting piece of work by the Bangalore group, by T.V. Ramakrishnan and his people. And they did a very nice calculation, which I like, because it is very elegant. They take, again, a Hubbard model, okay, so bosons move on the lattice. Now it's not hardcore, they have a repulsion U, okay, and this repulsion is a parameter of the problem, the bandwidth is here, and the filling is anything. Now, of course, you expect to have a localization only if you have an integer filling, because otherwise, or rational, but let me only look at the integer filling, otherwise the system is a conductor. So there were a number of attempts to treat this problem. One attempt was done by Jean-Philippe Bouchot in France, extending the Boots-Wheeler approximation to a boson gas, which is a nice calculation, but not particularly transparent. It turns out it's exactly equivalent to what TV did, and he did the following. He said, let me assume I have a Bose condensate here, okay, and I write the Bi as an expectation value plus a fluctuation. Okay, the expectation value is the other parameter of the Bose condensation. Delta Bi is a fluctuation. And now he's going to linearize the interaction to make a mean field approximation. So we are all used to linearize quartic operators, interactions. But if you do that, you get nowhere, okay, because you cannot really treat the problem anymore. What he does is to linearize the kinetic energy, okay, which is a very unexpected way to work. He writes at Bi star Bi. I write phi, the expectation value, which is here. And I write it as Bi star phi plus phi star, Bi star Bj, I'm sorry, plus phi star Bj minus phi star squared. Okay, that's standard linearization. And now you are left with a very simple problem because it is a single side problem. You see that this Hamiltonian here is a sum of Hamiltonians over each side. And the interaction is local, and this is local. So you have single side problems in which you can try to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. Now that can be done. It's not completely trivial because you have to cut. I mean, if you want to do an algebraic calculation, you must not let the number of bosons go to infinity. So you must put in cutoff and max. Then the steps are minimized with respect to the order parameter phi, okay, and then adjust the chemical potential here so that we have the right total number of particles. Then you do it with increasing and max, and it doesn't move anymore. You decide, you stop, that you have reached convergence. So that requires some care, but it's perfectly well controlled.
What is the small parameter in the expansion in approximation?
What is a small parameter? The approximation basically is an approximation where you can linearize, you can neglect the correlation of fluctuations on different sides.
Okay?
It's exact.
It probably gives exact anything.
It's the range somehow, the inverse of the
hard. Yeah. So if you do that, then you find that the superfluid density is just phi square, and the results of TV, which are what I gave you the reference on precedent transparencies, are shown here. And you see, for instance, that if you are if you look as a function of u for either integer filling, that's a phase diagram, that's right. At integer filling as a function of u, you find that you have a sharp transition at a given value of u between a state which is phi as a function of u, between a state which is a superfluid state, and a state which is an insulator with phi equals 0. If you have intermediate filling, then rho s goes smoothly through the transition, and the system is always a superfluid, as it should be. So this is a nice confirmation of the fact that if you have a strong repulsion, the system localizes when it has an integer filling. All right.
What was the axis on the when the phase diagram was, what was it?
I'm sorry.
What was the phase diagram that you plotted?
I plotted, well, you see, it's a picture which I took from the paper. So there, there are two things. There is a phase diagram as a function of t, okay? That's the, this curve here is a phase diagram as a function of t, superfluid metal insulator transition here. And this curve here is another vertical scale, which is rho s as a function of u at t equals 0. That's the picture. I mean, probably had to save space with figures, so we put two figures on the same one. All right. Oh, I have to shorten. God bless you.
Sorry.
Okay, so. Let me finish by reminding you of some rather old work, which is this other issue, which is dissociation of bosons into fermions. Now that's something which is now very well known, and I should not, what I want simply is to comment on recent developments. Now it is accepted that you go smoothly if you vary the strength of the interaction. You go smoothly from a BCS superconductor to a Bose-Einstein condensate of bound pairs. Basically, if I have a bound pair like that, I construct the Hartree approximation for the bound pairs in this form here. This is the essentially the Bose order parameters. B0 star phi is just a product of the Bose order parameter times the internal wave function of the pair. And this wave function describes simply in lowest order a Bose condensate of bound pairs. Now, if I expand this, because B0 star is a sum of k minus k pairs, all the terms commute with each other. So this wave function is also this wave function here. And it turns out into the BCS wave function. So you go smoothly from the BCS wave function in the limit of very weak coupling to the Bose-Einstein condensation of bound pairs in the limit of strong coupling. The evolution as a function of density of particles of coupling is quite straightforward. And I simply, this is also old stuff, so I remind you on that. If I have a very small density, then the bound pairs are very far from each other. They are like point bosons. And this vk squared, the vk of BCS, is just the internal wave function scaled by the number of density of particles n0 cubed. If I increase the density, that first goes up without change in the abscissa because the internal wave function remains the same until I reach, I approach 1, then I'm stuck with the exclusion principle, which the forbids me to put more than one particle in each fermion state. So if I want now to add even more particles, the only way out is to extend this curve further to the right. And you see I'm going to go smoothly from this picture, which is a Bose-Einstein condensation of preformed fermion pairs, to this picture, which is the usual BCS superconductivity. Also for history, I once crossed John Bardeen in Grenoble well, a few years before he died. And I had done this work not long before, so I tried to convince him that superconductivity was indeed Bose-Einstein condensation of fermion pairs, and he flatly refused to accept my views. So, but I think now it's widely accepted. So look at the evolution of the various parameters between the two limits, and also this is fairly well understood. In the dilute limit, the chemical potential is near the bound state. The gap is the energy needed to break the pair, and therefore it is a binding energy. And as you increase n, the gap goes down, and the chemical potential goes up, enters the continuum, and becomes a free Fermi chemical potential for a very large n. So this is a smooth evolution. The one thing which is completely different in the two limits, and that's important, is the critical temperature. if you are in the dilute limit, the critical temperature, in the dense limit, I'm sorry, in the BCS limit, if you are in the BCS limit, the critical temperature is the one where you break the pairs. Basically, the binding only exists because you have superfluid order. It is what makes superconducting order. It is what creates a gap. Okay, and so when the temperature increases, the gap goes down, and the superconductivity disappears when the pairs break. In the dilute limit, which is the opposite limit, where you have bound pairs, the pairs are atomic objects, so they don't break. But what destroys superfluidity is their center of mass motion, the fact that they acquire finite kinetic energy, like bosons in helium-4. And therefore, the critical temperature is simply h bar squared over md squared, which is much smaller than the binding energy. And so this has been advocated by a number of people as a possible explanation of the so-called pseudo-gap behavior in the ITC materials, where TC will be controlled by phase fluctuations, and delta G would be essentially the breaking energy of underlying bound pairs. So one can put a little more flesh on that and try to estimate at which value of the gap delta you turn from one regime to the other. Okay? So that's a very simple calculation, which probably many of you know, but when I first did it on the back of an envelope, I was very surprised by the result. So maybe some people don't know it. So the center of mass motion of bound pair is the same as putting phase fluctuations of the order parameter. Okay, that's fairly clear. If I have an order parameter delta, and if now make its phase fluctuate in space with delta e to the iqr, that determines the velocity, okay, and therefore phase fluctuations of the order parameter are the same as center of mass velocity fluctuations. And the idea now is that there is a mechanism for TC which we correspond to a situation where the thermal fluctuations of the phase phi at a given point are so large that they reach 2 pi. So you lose memory. There is no phase locking anymore. And you get an approximate estimate of the critical temperature by doing that. Now, there is one case where you can do the calculation to the end. And with no time, I didn't describe it in detail, but it's well known. It's in two dimensions, because in two dimensions, you can treat this problem exactly as this old Custodes-Thouless problem, in which in 2D, you have vortex singularities, which are point singularities. And the phase transition is reached when a vortex-anti-vortex pair unbinds in much the same way as a plus-minus charge unbinds in the Mott-insulator transition. It's the same mechanism. So one can do this calculation in detail and get the exact quotation mark result in 2D that the Custodes-Thouless transition temperature is just related to the phase stiffness of the system. The phase stiffness defined as saying that if I have a gradient of the phase phi, I pay an energy 1/2 volume integral, surface integral, I'm sorry, of lambda times grad phi squared. This is known as the phase stiffness. Now, I say exact calculation because what matters is lambda at TC and not lambda at T equals zero. And so there is a renormalization problem which I will not handle, but which is relatively well controlled. Now, the one feature I want to point out, very, very trivial, is the fact that if I do that, I'm going to find a crossover from the Custodes-Thouless regime to the BCS regime, which is very early. I mean, my guess was that basically you went from one regime to the other when the chemical potential entered the continuum. Okay, that was still one way to locate the transition between the Bose-Einstein regime and the BCS regime. And as you will see, that is not the case. Now, here, one remark. As I said, lambda here is lambda at temperature T. Now, that allows a very neat blending of the BCS mechanism and the Costa-Lucares mechanism. If I had a BCS theory, I will find that the phase stiffness disappears at TCBCS. Okay, it's clear that if I reach TCBCS, there is no pair anymore, and therefore the amplitude of the other parameter is zero, and its phase doesn't matter. Okay, so I expect that lambda vanishes at TCBCS. This is a purple curve here. And now I must look for the actual transition temperature as a solution of this implicit equation, where lambda does be dependent on T. Okay, the actual TC will be a root of the equation T equals pi over 2 lambda of T. So I can draw the straight line 2T over pi here, and you see I have two regimes. One regime in which the slope is very small. Okay, that's the case of a dense gas. In this case, the transition temperature will be here, and fluctuations will be essentially negligible, except in this very small region, and I'm just describing a Ginzburg criterion for a phase transition. Okay, so that's expected. If the slope is very large instead, then the transition temperature is basically the bare Costa-Lucares transition temperature at T equals zero, and I am in the BEC regime. So I'm now going to look at what is the value of the delta being a measure of the BCS effect, for which two transition temperatures are equal. That will give me an idea of where the transition lies. All right, so the calculation is, I said, back of the envelope. Okay, I need to calculate the phase stiffness, but for free electrons, this is trivial, because it's just getting an invariance. Putting a superfluid current is shifting the Fermi surface by Q, or rather by Q over 2, if Q is the moment is a pair momentum, by Q over 2. And therefore, I calculate the total energy as the number of particles times the kinetic energy. Now, the number of particles in 2D is well known. And if I do put all of this together, I get that the phase stiffness is epsilon F, the Fermi energy, divided by 4 pi. Now, for a series, 4 pi is equal to 1. This is what I learned in Feynman's book, in the preface of Feynman's book. But for an experimenter, it's not really. And if you plug that into the Costa-Lucares formula, you find that the BCS temperature is equal to the Costa-Lucares temperature, which means a crossover from pair breaking to pair fluctuations, when the gap is typically 0.2 epsilon f. And that's worrying, because that means that at the crossover, the chemical potential is still way inside the continuum. Okay, that means that you have a very broad range of parameters in which phase fluctuations are dominant, and the idea of preformed bosons makes no sense at all. We have no bound state inside the continuum. Okay, so the question arises, how does one treat this regime? And I know of no way, there is no theory that I know of, which is able to handle phase fluctuations in a region of parameters where you do not have genuine bound states. I mean, the crossover, as I said, is not at all when the chemical potential gets out of the band. It's way, way before, when delta is so small that the chemical potential has not moved, essentially, because in that range of energy, the role of the slope of the density of states is irrelevant. So that's something which is an open question. And I think it's, to me, one of the major theoretical challenges is to make a reliable theory of TC in a very simple model. Okay, it's just a regular electron gas, but in a range of parameters where phase fluctuations are already the dominant mechanism, and nevertheless, there is no physical picture can account for that. Okay, so I think I will skip the end of my talk because let me simply show you a couple of transparency and I will skip the rest. So led by this idea that there are regions where you may have a superconductivity which changes its nature at a scale much smaller than the Fermi energy, we looked with a postdoc in Grenoble, Fabio Pistolesi, a bright young fellow, had a very simple problem. And basically, we tried to see how we could have a superconducting transition in a system where the gap has nothing to do with superconductivity. This is a very old idea. I mean, there are a number of people who claim that the pseudo gap is not something which is due to superconductivity itself. It's something which is simply due to some extraneous origin, lattice phase transition, some sort of order. I mean, Jacques Friedel, for instance, believes very strongly that anti-ferromagnetic order is responsible for the pseudo gap. So we don't want to answer that question. We don't know the answer. We simply said, let's take a semiconductor, okay? And since I have 2D in mind, I took a semiconductor with a constant density of states like this, okay? And add to that an attraction. Okay? And can you develop superconductivity out of a semiconductor directly? And what would be the physics of this transition between a semiconducting state and a superconducting state? Turns out that the calculation is elementary. It's a problem which only has two energies, two characteristic energies. Well, there's more, but some are relevant. You need a bandwidth, of course, to have convergent integrals. You have a semiconducting gap, which I've put by hand, comes from something else. And you have the interaction strength, and this I will measure by what would be the superconducting gap delta if I didn't have delta zero. Okay, it's a way to measure the strength of the interaction. And eventually, if you dope it, you have a third energy, which is the number of particles in the conduction band. I will forget about doping for lack of time. So now the calculation is elementary, and the results are instructive. We can write a BCS closure equation. Let me take the undoped case. When undoped case, the chemical potential is in the middle of a gap, okay, like an insulator. So I can measure psi from here, and the real superconducting order parameter delta is given by the usual BCS closure equation. The only difference is that you integrate from delta 0 to omega m instead of 0 to omega m. Now that's very easy to do, and you get this result here. Okay, that delta is equal to square root of delta m times delta m minus 2 delta 0. The actual gap is the square root of delta 0 square plus delta square, because psi k has a minimum value. It's delta m minus delta 0. Well, see, they are not very complicated calculations. So the results are shown on the next transparency. I will put this later. Okay. And this is a final transparency, which shows the behavior as a function of the strength of the semiconductor's gap delta zero compared to the superconductor's gap delta zero. This is the other parameter at t equals zero. You see that it goes to zero when delta zero is equal to delta m. And that describes, very simply, a direct transition from a superconducting state on that side to an insulator on that side. Okay. The gap delta g, the gap for quasi-particles, is a straight line up to here, and then it becomes this usual delta zero on the other side, so it has this shape here. And you see that in this region here, I have generated a situation where the other parameter is generically much smaller than the real gap for quasi-particles. And the one thing which is interesting, and I will end on that, is that the TC, the critical temperature of this system, is very, very unusual. You can easily calculate the BCS TC. Okay, the BCS TC, this curve here, which essentially is the theory. It's a little bit more complicated because of the boundaries and the integrals, but it's basically the BCS critical temperature with small numerical changes. But the actual critical temperature is much smaller and is controlled by phase fluctuations. And now, this is a point which may be general. Let me think about the phase stiffness in this problem. The phase stiffness is I've calculated by saying I translate the Fermi surface by Q, and I calculate the corresponding energy, the center of mass energy. If I do a translation by Q in a filled band, I do nothing, because all states are filled. Okay. So in this system, which is nearly localized, the phase stiffness is controlled entirely by the superconducting fluctuations. It is the superconducting fluctuation that do provide some leeway in the band and allow for an energy cost in shifting the Fermi surface. Therefore, the phase stiffness is not at all the Fermi energy or the bandwidth. It is the delta itself. Okay, it's a quantity which allows, which provides some leeway to create a translation. Now, you can do an exact calculation. This is absolutely elementary. And you find the phase stiffness is given by this. And the Kosar Stylus transition temperature is this value here, which is just this curve here. Okay? So the we do have...
Wait, sorry, the phase stiffness you calculate within BCS theory. Okay.
No, I calculate... The Kosar Stylus temperature is pi over 2 lambda.
Yeah.
Okay? And lambda, which I call the phase stiffness, is calculated with my BCS theory, and maybe I shift it by a Q. It's simple effect of translation. So the one question I'm asking is it a generic feature? I'm not sure. I don't know. That if a system is close to being an insulator, it necessarily has a very small phase stiffness. My belief is yes, but I'm not sure it is a generic feature. In this example, anyway, it's what happens. Now, I wanted to conclude this by making a note on this calculation. Basically, what you have described here is a situation in which you gain, you have no free carriers, but the free carriers are due to the superconducting fluctuations. Okay, basically, you bind more, you gain more energy by binding a Cooper pair of two carriers, and you pay for producing the Cooper pair. And this is extremely reminiscent of something which is very familiar here, which is the Cohn's excitonic insulator, which is basically the same, exactly the same mechanism, where he was looking not at an attractive gas, but at a repulsive gas, Coulombic repulsion, but not at a particle pair, but at a particle hole pair. Okay? And his statement was, if the gap is smaller than the binding energy of the exciton, then the excitons appear spontaneously. What I'm describing here is a transcription of the Cohn's excitonic insulator to particle pairs in an attractive gas. So all of that has no pretense at being realistic. It simply aims to ask questions that may be of general, more general usefulness than the case I'm considering. Okay, so I'm nearly in time, 5 minutes left.